Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. As the Democratic presidential candidates head into their final debate tonight, which, like the few previous ones, has been buried by the Democratic National Committee, this time on a holiday weekend up against an NFL playoff game and Downton Abbey, we'll begin with an analysis of how much the Hillary Clinton campaign underestimated Bernie Sanders, who was ahead in the polls in New Hampshire and neck and neck in Iowa, with better numbers in a general election race against Donald Trump. Democratic strategist Simon Rosenberg joins us. He is the president and founder of the New Democrat Network and previously worked on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns and was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. We will discuss the strength and sophistication of the Sanders campaign that has apparently caught the overconfident, presumptive winners, the Clinton campaign, by surprise. Then we'll look into the prisoner swap with Iran as oil and financial sanctions are lifted on Iran following its compliance with the P5 plus one nuclear deal. Dr. Mohsen Sazagara, who was a founder of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps before clashing with the Supreme Leader, resulting in his arrest in 2003, joins us to discuss the power struggle going on behind the scenes in Iran over who will succeed the ailing Supreme Leader, whose son, Mojtaba Khamenei, is jockeying to succeed his father. This ironically mirrors the power struggle underway with Iran's arch foe Saudi Arabia, where the ailing King Salman may abdicate the throne in favor of his controversial 30-year-old son, bypassing the designated successor, America's favorite, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. Then finally, we'll get an update on the massive methane leak at Porter Ranch in the northern suburbs of Los Angeles following a postponement by the Southern California Air Quality District of a hearing now scheduled for January the 20th at a location far from the site of the leak that has forced 12,000 residents from their homes. Matt Pacucco, a engineer and co-founder of Save Porter Ranch, joins us to discuss whether attempts by the Southern California Gas Company to plug the leak that began in October have made things worse and whether efforts to capture the gas might ignite it. And joining us now is Simon Rosenberg, who's the president and founder of the New Democratic Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. Welcome to Background Briefing, Simon Rosenberg.
Good to be here, Ian.
And tonight's debate on NBC, again, on a weekend, going to be up against these important NFL playoff games. Probably not going to get the kind of ratings that the Republicans have been getting, but it's pretty crucial because the New York Times has a piece on Sunday indicating that at least some people in the Clinton campaign feel that she underestimated Bernie Sanders and maybe is in a kind of panic mode at the moment. How would you describe the...
Sure. I don't know if they're in a panic mode, but certainly they now know they have a race. And the Democratic race is very competitive now. I mean, the truth is that Bernie Sanders could win. He's not. I think Hillary is still the likely victor in this race. But, you know, Sanders has had a few polls showing him up in Iowa. And if he wins Iowa and New Hampshire, you know, he is certainly in a very strong position then to continue to give her either a run or even win the nomination. So I think what you're seeing is the Clinton campaign changing strategy. They're engaging him now much more directly and challenging him on a whole wide array of issues to try to weaken him because they know they need to. If they win Iowa, she can put this thing away pretty quickly. If they don't win Iowa, then this thing could go on for a long time.
So do you think this is also, in terms of why she's behind the eight ball, is that this is an unusual year, that these anti-establishment candidates on the Republican side, Trump and Cruz, although arguably Cruz is particularly getting million-dollar loans from Citibank and Goldman Sachs, it's hard to portray him as a anti-establishment character, but nevertheless, that's how he's portraying himself. But clearly, Bernie Sanders is. And so is that a part of the mix here, that this is just a different political year and the public are sick of politicians and anybody that seems to be out of that mold is doing well?
Look, there's there's something very, I think, potentially profound going on in the U.S. And if you look at what's happened in Europe, you know, you're seeing a weakening of the traditional political parties in Europe. Certainly the center-left is suffering terribly in Europe right now. You know, the Labour Party is going through enormous challenges in the U.K., and we've seen it in other countries. It's possible there's something similar going on here now. I mean, you have a situation where if Trump and Sanders win their nominations, each of those candidates will have had no real history with the party that they've now taken over. And Trump has not been historically an active Republican. Bernie Sanders wasn't even a Democrat until a few months ago. And so it speaks to the incredible disruption that's going on and sort of the discontent and the change and the transformation. It's not all negative and angry. There's also just new stuff going on. And so, yeah, I mean, the political establishment of both parties are getting heavily challenged now. It's more pronounced on the Republican side because, you know, if you look at the demographics of their electorate there, you know, there's more anger and frustration and than there is on the Democratic side. I mean, there's a very big difference between the way Republicans and Democrats see the economy, for example, and also the age of our coalitions. And so this is more pronounced on the Republican side. But, yeah, this is manifesting itself on the Democratic side. And I think to some degree the Clinton campaign, if I could summarize my own view about what the Clinton campaign has done, is that after that very strong set of weeks she had with that, you know, with the debate and with her very strong performance around the Benghazi hearing, you know, I think they took their foot off the gas a little bit, you know, and I think that whether they underestimated Sanders, they didn't close it. I think they believed they had won by that point and that she had been so strong and so powerful and her poll numbers, you know, soared so quickly, and she's been in a downward path ever since. The debates, to your point, have been hidden. I mean, the debate strategy on our side has been inexcusable, how ignorant and wrong it's been for the interests of all Democrats. The Republicans will get at least 100 million more, you know, views during their debates than we will. It could be as high as 150, you know, million over the course of the debates. And so she's been hidden, and she hasn't had the tools that the Republican candidates have had to go speak to voters to where she's done very well. I mean, every time Hillary's been on TV in these sort of confrontational settings, right, she does really well. And they, you know, she working with the DNC, apparently, according to the Times today, right, sort of, you know, knocked these debates into places where very few people would see them. And I think it's done enormous damage to her and to the whole Democratic Party. I mean, I've been very publicly critical of this for months. And so, yeah, we got a race on our hands. And I think on the Republican side, there is a race. But I think Trump, you know, my own view is that at this point, Trump is in far better shape than Cruz is for lots of different reasons. And he's likely to, you know, come out the other end on their side.
And again, I'm speaking with Simon Rosenberg, who's the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. So is that to say then, Simon, that when Hillary was on a roll there after the Benghazi hearings and after her performances in the debates, the idea that the DNC and the assumption is that to some extent that was done at Hillary's behest, buried these debates. Again, that seems like conventional politics as opposed to the unconventional politics that Bernie Sanders is practicing with grassroots money pouring in, etc. And, of course, Donald Trump is totally unconventional. He hasn't spent any money. He's getting free media. So are they just as an organization? Because one of the things I think that some of the Clinton supporters are worried about is that this could be a repeat of the 2008 campaign where she was the anointed winner and this upstart Barack Obama caught her by surprise. And most people were very critical of the way her campaign was handled. Would you level any criticism at the way her current campaign is being handled?
You know, I don't have a strong opinion about this. There are people who will voice stronger opinions. They've clearly, I mean, look, the data is the data, and this race is much closer than they want it to be. Sanders is much stronger than, I think, you know, the national media sort of wrote him off starting in November. And despite him announcing that he had gotten to 2 million donors faster than Barack Obama did in 2007, 2008, you know, him having the enormous capacity to raise money, lots of advertising on the air, you know, tons of, you know, organizers on the ground. I mean, this was a really serious national campaign. And Sanders, even, you know, the fact, you know, as I wrote several weeks ago, there are only four candidates right now in this race who are leading in an early state: Sanders, Clinton, Trump, and Cruz. And so Sanders has always been in the upper tier of this field. It's just nobody ever treated it that way. There was this assumption that Hillary was going to win. And so I think that, you know, the evolution of the Sanders campaign from sort of being passed over to becoming this sort of powerhouse, people missed a lot of signals that were, you know, being given along the way. And whether the Clinton people did or didn't, I mean, certainly they've changed their strategy now. But I think that you have to give the Sanders campaign enormous credit for having run a remarkable campaign, for having built, you know, a very strong, you know, national fundraising operation that's almost matched Hillary dollar for dollar, which is incredible, right, in what they've done, without there really being, to your point about Trump, right, doing it in a very different way than Trump. Sanders hasn't been doing a lot of national TV. They haven't been, you know, working the national press. He's been doing a lot of this through his, you know, his physical presence, the rallies that he's been having. He's earning this the old-fashioned way in some ways, right? And they're using the internet, you know, very effectively. So this has been an impressive campaign, and I think, you know, he's earned his spot here. I mean, he's got a chance and he's got a shot. And I think certainly in the way that you've watched him respond to the Clinton attacks in the last few days, you know, they're ready. I mean, they can handle it. I mean, this is a mature, sophisticated campaign. They're not panicking. They're giving as well as they're getting, right? And I think one of the real interesting moments tonight is going to be, you know, how does Sanders, we know that Hillary is going to go after Bernie because she has in every debate. I mean, she's roughed him up in every debate. Bernie is clearly not going after her at all, right? In fact, gave her the pass on the email, the famous pass on the email stuff in the first debate. The thing to watch is what he does tonight, right? This is a big debate. I mean, if he can knock Clinton down a few points, he can win Iowa, he's then really in the hunt. And he's not really gone after her. And so I assume you're going to see him take a couple very strategic shots at her. And they'll probably be around this issue of her being part of the financial elite and being too close to Wall Street and being, you know, part of the a corrupt establishment that isn't serving the needs of the party. I assume that that's where they're going to sort of spend a lot of time tonight. But we'll see.
Well, it seems that her recent attacks on him and using her daughter Chelsea as a surrogate, which seem to have backfired on the healthcare issue, just seems very misplaced to me, because there's such an enormous difference between the Democrats, particularly those two Democrats, Sanders and Clinton, and the Republicans. They're worlds apart. So yeah. Why make those sort of penny-ante differences? Why not focus on the fact that the Republicans are so obdurate and reactionary on healthcare?
Well, because she's got to draw a contrast. I mean, look, she has to win the election, and she has to win the nomination. And I think that they feel that, you know, Bernie is vulnerable in a bunch of different ways, that his economic plan is not fully fleshed out. His health care plan was, you know, in their view, was not well thought through. They think he's in the wrong position on guns. And so they're going after him on, you know, this is a campaign. This is how you win and lose. You draw contrasts and you push and you try to break the other side and have them make mistakes. I mean, what's been interesting is that Sanders, you know, has been taking these punches, right, and parrying them, you know, pretty well. I mean, this is a real campaign. I mean, this is a sophisticated, far more sophisticated campaign than I think people realized, and they're handling it. I mean, they're in the hunt here. And so we've got a real fight on our side. And I still think Hillary is likely to prevail, but certainly the chance that Bernie may win, it's you know, rising every day, right? And the more that they can show that they can hang with her in these back and forths, and certainly, you know, I think watch tonight. I mean, she's going to go after him hard. She has in every debate. And, you know, how does he handle it? What I've been impressed with is that he just smiles and moves on. He doesn't really get rattled, right? You know, but somebody could, you know, there could be some significant moments tonight. And even though the debate viewership will probably be very low, and other people have written this, I mean, the reason why this debate schedule has been so bad for Hillary is that, you know, if you screw up and if there's a magic moment of some kind, everyone's going to see that in the next 24 hours on the internet, on TV. But if you do really well, the only people that are going to see that are going to be the people watching the debate, right? And so she's the way this has been set up is essentially enormous potential downside for her in every debate with very little upside, because the debate audience is so small and will be small tonight. So, you know, we'll see. I think this is a very consequential debate. Look, this is the last debate that the Democrats are having before Iowa and New Hampshire. This is it. I mean, this is also it for Martin O'Malley, and I think we should expect him to be, you know, super feisty and engaged tonight. The Republicans have, in January, February, March, the Republicans have 7 debates. The Democrats have 3, and one of ours is in Spanish. And so we only have 2 English language debates between, you know, now and when 60% of the country votes. The Republicans have 7 during that same period. So their candidates have, you know, they can pace themselves. You know, there's another Republican debate in 10 days, right? This is it tonight. I mean, this is it. This is the last one before Iowa and New Hampshire. So I expect this to be a very, you know, tough debate all the way around.
But in the sense that this is an unconventional year and that perhaps there's a new polity out there, at least a new constituency, that doesn't like politics as usual and is turned off by it. You mentioned in your recent article, Simon Rosenberg, at the New Democratic Network, America has in essence its own youth bulge, and how this generation swings politically might just determine which party reigns for the next 30 to 40 years, and much else about American culture. So if that's true, then Bernie Sanders is the one that's bringing the young people in, and the last thing the Democrats want is to alienate that constituency. If you've brought them into the tent, you don't want to drive them out of the tent.
Look, the truth is that, you know, it pure analysis here, right? I'm supporting Hillary, you know, I'm not a Bernie guy, I've been long-time friends with the Clintons. But, you know, they're, at a strategy level, Hillary's weakness with young people right now has to be unbelievably worrisome to the Democrats. And, you know, and so even if she wins the nomination, she's got a long way to go to, you know, increase her support and reintroduce herself to millennial voters to in order to win the general election. I mean, this is a structural weakness in her coalition right now that's very dangerous for her in the general election. There's no doubt about that. It doesn't mean that they're going to go to the Republicans, right? It doesn't mean that that Donald Trump or Ted Cruz are going to raid millennials and do well. But this is not a group. This is the largest generation in American politics now. There are more millennials in the electorate this cycle than there are boomers. Boomers are trending very Republican. Older people are moving, you know, and young people are very liberal and very Democratic. And so this is the base of the new coalition for the Democrats that is the best coalition the Democratic Party has had since the 1940s, right, when FDR built his very durable and sustainable coalition. And, you know, our candidate is not doing well with what is arguably the most important part of this new emergent 21st century coalition of the Democrats. Yeah, it's a problem. And it's, you know, and so you're right that in terms of how she handles this and how she needs, if you're a Clinton person, you have to defeat Sanders but not rough him up so much that you're going to alienate his own people, right? And that's one of the reasons why this thing that's gone on with the debates is so consequential, because if there's a narrative at the end of this in the Sanders camp that the way the DNC intervened in the campaign was illegitimate and that the system was rigged for Hillary, right, it's going to be far harder to bring along the Sanders people, you know, back into the Clinton coalition at the end of this process, which is why, you know, the Clinton campaign, in my mind, would have been very smart to have demanded more debates, you know, 2 months ago, and tried to make it look like they were being open and democratic and not, you know, sort of closed and gaming the system to her own advantage. And so, you know, yes, this matters. I mean, what happened with the data breach, you know, in December, which happened right before Christmas, so it didn't really get that much attention. You know, what the DNC did to the Sanders campaign was completely out of bounds. I mean, they essentially shut a presidential campaign down without any, you know, and violated the contract between the Sanders campaign and the DNC, were overly punitive, did not go through the dispute resolution process that was articulated in their contract. And that was another moment where it looked like the DNC was in an illegitimate way intervening in the primary process. To me, that was equally, or if not worse, than what they've done on the debates, because it was so clearly not allowed what they did. And it's one of the reasons they backed down. You know, the lawsuit is still in play. They haven't, you know, the Sanders campaign is suing the DNC for millions and millions of dollars of damages. And I think they're going to win, by the way, because I think what the DNC did was improper. So it's really important now that both the Clinton campaign, to your point, I mean, I'm agreeing with your basic point here, that this process has to be seen as having been fair. And if it isn't, it's going to make the eventual coming together of the Democratic coalition much harder in the summer and fall.
Well, just in closing, Simon Rosenberg, what do you make of the polls that, in the general, that put Bernie Sanders ahead of Hillary in competitions with both Ted Cruz and with Donald Trump?
Here's what I believe. I think it's going to be a very competitive general election, and I think Trump can win. And I know people think that that's impossible, but if you look at some of the more recent polling, right, Trump is within 2, 3, 4 points of Hillary in some of the polls. I think he's going to be a far stronger candidate in the general election. He's been masterful with media. I'm not dismissive of him. I'm taking him seriously. I don't want to. Democrats shouldn't go through what they did with Reagan. I mean, the Democrats were very dismissive of Reagan, believed that he was a crazy person. He could never get elected president. He crushed us in 1980 and 1984. And so, you know, I think this is going to be a highly competitive general election. And, you know, we don't know who the best Democratic candidate is. That's what the voters get to decide, right? That's why we have this primary process. And, you know, I think it's going to be Hillary. I think she's going to be prevail. I think she'll be both a better candidate and a better president. But Bernie Sanders is getting a shot here to make his case. And what I love about our system is that it's very entrepreneurial. It's very, you know, it's capitalism at work here. It's deeply competitive, and the best person comes out the other end of it, right? And so I think that's why these next few weeks are going to be so consequential on our side, because we have no guaranteed path for victory in the fall. I think it's going to be a very competitive general election, whoever the Republican is. And so, you know, that's why this engagement, what we need is Hillary, Greg Sargent from The Washington Post wrote a terrific piece about this a few days ago. Hillary needs this challenge. She needs to look like she had a tough challenge and overcame it if she wins, right? I mean, if she loses, that's, you know, it doesn't matter. But, I mean, she needs to come out of this as a victor, right? You know, standing on top of the defeated enemy in a martial way, right? Her coasting to victory was going to be very bad for her in a million ways, right? And these kind of moments, you know, campaigns can rise and come, you know, and overcome, and the candidate can rise above this difficult situation. They come out the other end of this far stronger. And so I think that even if Hillary ends up winning the nomination, what's going on now is going to make her far stronger general election candidate in what I think is going to be a very competitive general election.
Well, Simon Rosenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Ian, I appreciate the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Simon Rosenberg, who's the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the prisoner swap with Iran as oil and financial sanctions are lifted on Iran following its compliance with the P5+1 nuclear deal.
You don't need to change. The future's odd. You don't need to change.
Oh, it must go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Mohsen Sazegara, who is an Iranian journalist and pro-democracy political activist, who was a founder of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and held several high-ranking positions during the early years of the Iranian Revolution. He served as Deputy Prime Minister in Political Affairs, Deputy Minister for Heavy Industry, Deputy Chairman of the Budget and Planning Department, and many more positions before becoming disillusioned with the government in 1989 and pushing for reforms. His reformist policies clashed with the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, eventually resulting in his arrest in 2003, and he now resides in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mohsen Sazegara.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So this prisoner swap, along with the lifting of sanctions against Iran following its compliance with the International Atomic Energy Agency on the P5 plus one nuclear deal, has obviously been greeted certainly by the families with a great deal of joy. The Republicans, who have been demonizing the deal all along and really say that extraordinary things about President Obama in these presidential debates, they're looking a bit foolish, I think, because they've sort of almost invested in things getting a lot worse with Iran. But I think there's a lot more going on in Iran behind the scenes, as there is indeed in Saudi Arabia in terms of succession. So do you have to put that in the context of what's going on with this deal?
Definitely. You know, all politics are local. Whatever is going on in Iran, one of the main roots is in internal politics of Iran. Everybody knows that the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, is sick. He has cancer, and the succession crisis is one of the most important crises which is on the way in Iran. On these days, on February 27, will be Assembly of Experts election, besides to parliamentary election. And Assembly of Experts has 89 seats, and in charge of electing the next leader. The term is 8 years. So there is tough competition right now in Iran. Who will have the Assembly of Experts, next Assembly of Experts, because this Assembly of Experts, which will be elected, definitely will choose and elect the next leader of Iran. And many competitions is going on. There are several factions in Iran fighting each other. But the main three factions that have the most of the power in their hands, one is House of the Leader, and his son, Mojtaba, his second son, who has started to get several points of power for to become the next leader, and Revolutionary Guard, which they have money, they have handcuffs, they have the several facilities in their hands, and President Rouhani, who has the government and the ambition to become the next leader. So they are fighting each other. And what is going on in nuclear deal, somehow Rouhani wants to use that to mobilize the people behind himself to have more power to fight with two other factions, which easily they unite to each other against him if the present leader dies.
Well, Mojtaba Khamenei, of course, is a real hardliner. He's close to the Revolutionary Guard Corps. He apparently was responsible for the ascension of Ahmadinejad to the presidency. He's got a ton of money behind him, but he doesn't have the religious credentials. But then again, his father, the current supreme leader, didn't really have the religious credentials either, did he?
No, he didn't. And isn't he, by the force, he was imposed as a grand Ayatollah and got the power. So his son is almost in the age that he became the leader 27 years ago. And I think that although Mojtaba does not have enough religious credential, but it's not so important. The problem is that who has the main sources of money, who has the main sources of propaganda, and more important, who has the main sources of bare power, as Bertrand Russell says. I mean, guns and military forces.
Well, that is the key. If you say that this succession crisis could destabilize the country, we know from the Green Revolution, which, by the way, Mujtaba, through the militia that he controls, put that down rather brutally. So just look at a scenario then of if this succession crisis takes to the streets, the only institution that we're not talking about here is the Iranian army. So at the end of the day, if the Revolutionary Guard Corps factions are fighting each other, and they're fighting, both are fighting President Rouhani, what do you think the role of the military would be?
It's a good question. The classic army of Iran, it's three times more powerful than Revolutionary Guard and three times bigger than Revolutionary Guard. But they are neutral in politics so far during the last 37 years of the history of revolution. But it doesn't mean that they don't have any ambition in politics of Iran. And at least they can be used as a counterbalance to Revolutionary Guard in the scene if the people come to streets, if the people come to the scene to support, for instance, Rouhani or anybody else for leadership. This is the reason that Rouhani needs the deal to show that to the people that he's the guy who can solve the problem, who can solve the economic crisis of Iran, high inflation, high unemployment rate, and deep recession of Iran. So he needs this deal. But I really doubt that he can solve the economic problem of Iran, especially corruption problem, which is everywhere. And the main sources of the economy of Iran are controlled by House of the Leader and Revolutionary Guard. 45% of Iran economy is controlled by these two institutions. I mean, House of the Leader and Revolutionary Guard, and they don't answer to anybody. They are out of any control and accountability.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Mohsen Sazagara, who's an Iranian journalist and pro-democracy political activist. He was a founder of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and held several high-ranking positions during the early years of the Iranian Revolution, serving as Deputy Prime Minister in Political Affairs, Deputy Minister for Heavy Industry, Deputy Chairman of the Budget and Planning Department, and many more before he became disillusioned with the government, pushed for reforms. His reformist policies clashed with the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, eventually resulting in Mohsen's arrest in 2003, and he now resides in the United States. So in terms of the prisoner swap that's just underway, there is one important prisoner in Iran that wasn't released, and my understanding is that the Revolutionary Guard Corps put him in prison because he was the conduit for the President Rouhani, the reformist president, to the Obama White House. And they basically arrested this guy to send a signal to Obama that you got to deal with us, the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. You're right. You mean Siamak Namazi, the Iranian American businessman who got lots of money, he and his company, during the Rafsanjani and Khatami, two ex-presidents of Iran. And actually, he's the guy and his company who support NAIAC, National Iranian American Council in the U.S., who is actually acts as a lobby for government of Rouhani in White House. Revolutionary Guard arrested him about 3 months ago to send a significant signal to White House that you can't deal with only Rouhani if you want to have any deal with Iran. Now that he has not been released, again, it's another signal that shows to White House that you should think twice. This is not enough just to deal with Rouhani, or just you think that you can deal on nuclear issue and then everything is going to be normalized if Revolutionary Guard doesn't want that. So I think that looking at what will happen to Siamake Namazi is something that can show us again another part of the battle of power inside Iran.
But if the IRGC controls over 40% of the economy, along with Khomeini's family, the supreme leader's family, Khomeini's family, how can the U.S. deal with them? I mean, so obviously, Rouhani, the president, managed to calm down that capture of the American sailors, and I don't imagine that they wanted anything to prevent the money coming through on this deal. But I noticed in his press conference today, President Obama did reach out to the Iranian people, particularly referring to the young Iranians wanting to be a part of the world. And how do you reach out to the Iranian people around the power of the gun and the money that the IRGC and the Supreme Leader has?
Yeah, you're right. I mean that the private section in Iran is not so powerful. I think that the best way for Western countries, including United States, is first of all, if they want to deal with private section of Iran, try to make more powerful the private section of Iran. Second, there are several environmental issues in Iran, especially air pollution and water, which is the big crisis in Iran. And everybody talks that in next 2 decades, about 50 million Iranians should be displaced if the problem of drought and water will not be solved. So I mean that in these issues that all the people are concerned, cooperation with private section of Iran is one of the best solutions for Western companies to show that they are in the side of the people of Iran. But besides to that, we have civil society movements in Iran. I mean labor activists, teacher associations, lawyers, journalists, many student movement, women movement, minorities movements. We have several layers of the society which are not satisfied with this regime. And although many of their leaders and activists are in jail now, but the organizations still they are active and they oppose this regime. For instance, we have 6.5 million industrial workers in Iran. Many of the factories of Iran are going to be closed. They are in they are working under capacity, sometimes 20% of their capacity, and they have to lay off many of their staff and workers. So there are very good motivations for several factions of Iran that oppose this regime, join the strikes, and go for civil resistance. So I mean that because that the main power comes from the people, mobilizing the people for civil resistance is the best way that can paralyze this regime and ends the theocracy which is running Iran and transferring the country to a democracy.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, there is a peculiar and ironic mirror here of the power struggle underway with Iran's arch foe, Saudi Arabia, where the ailing king, Salman, may abdicate the throne in favor of his controversial 30-year-old son, thus bypassing the designated successor, who is Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who is very much a favorite of Washington. And people have been quite concerned about the 30-year-old king's son, who's effectively running the kingdom. And there's, of course, obviously a comparison there with Mojtaba Khamenei trying to jockey for position to take over from his father in Iran. And the idea of two spoiled brats facing off across the Gulf, running these two powerful countries that are at each other's throats, is a very troubling one.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I of course, I'm not an expert of Saudi Arabia politics, but as far as I know, regime of Saudi Arabia, they have lots of difficulties inside that regime and tough competition between the two crown princes, first and second one. And don't forget that they are Wahhabis. They are very Sunni hardliners, and Iran has a Shia hardliner, and fighting Shiis and Sunnis in that region is one of the most dangerous crises in whole Middle East. So, yeah, right now they have in deep crisis, these two countries, and any changes toward radicals in these two countries will make the crisis worse than now.
Well, of course, yeah, there's a minority of Shi'i in Saudi Arabia, and there's also a minority of Sunni in Iran.
Exactly.
So that's where the flashpoint is, I guess, and it's clear that the young Saudi son of the king was deliberately arrested the Shia cleric to provoke Iran. So there's some dangerous activities going on. I thank you for joining us, Dr. Mohsen Sazagara.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mohsen Sazagara, who's an Iranian journalist and pro-democracy political activist who was a founder of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. He held several high-ranking positions during the early years of the Iranian Revolution, serving as Deputy Prime Minister in Political Affairs, Deputy Minister for Heavy Industry, Deputy Chairman of the Budget and Planning Department, and many other positions before becoming disillusioned and pushing for reforms. His reformist policies clashed with the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, eventually resulting in Mohsen's arrest in 2003. He now lives in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and back getting an update on the massive methane leak at Porter Ranch.
I can hold my head still with my hands at my knees. These eyes are the eyes of the old, shivering and bold. I will try not to breathe. This decision is mine. I have lived a full life. These are the eyes that I.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mac Pacuco, who is a music producer and engineer based in Porter Ranch, where he recently co-founded Save Porter Ranch to spread awareness of the ongoing methane leak and urge lawmakers to act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Pacuco.
Hey, thanks, Ian, for having me on here. And just to be clear, we were founded in April 2014, long before this leak sprung.
I see. Well, I guess the thing that strikes me, and it's a similar situation to what's happening with the water in Flint, Michigan, that has thousands of times more lead than than is safe, and could be causing brain damage amongst thousands of children. This is an extraordinary case, though, of a kind of corporate indifference, if not a cover-up, because this leak started back in October, and I don't recall much publicity about it for up until fairly recently, and it only came to light, as far as I can tell, because of the activities of groups like yours and the outrage that the citizens were feeling in the neighborhood because they were having adverse health effects, which is exactly what happened in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, to make the long story short, when we first discovered the leaks for our social media, you know, our group has been around for a while, so we're dialed into the social media of the neighborhood, and we found out the leak was going on. Everyone knew that there was something wrong with so much gas in the neighborhoods. We confirmed the leak with two local authorities, and people were getting sick from day one. So we kept sounding the alarm. It took the gas company 3 days to even mention in a small Facebook post that there was anything wrong. They actually lied on their emergency hotline number. And then they didn't even notify health department until the seventh day after the leak started.
And at this point, do you have any understanding of I read a report in the Los Angeles Times that an independent engineer said that the gas company's efforts to plug the leak have actually made it worse and made the hole down below even bigger, where there could be a even bigger blowout. And the other report that one hears is that there was a safety valve originally on the because these are old oil wells that were then repurposed to store gas, and that this 61-year-old, back in 1979, they didn't replace the they took the safety valve out and didn't replace it. So walk us through some of those stories. Let's start with, have efforts to plug the hole made the situation worse?
I'm going to go back to that, but chronologically, yeah, back in 1979, they had a problem with the subsurface safety valve, which was not technically required at the time. So they, instead of replacing it like any, you know, good company would do, they decided just to remove it. So that's gone since like 79. So when we get up to now, and when this thing sprung its leak from a cracked casing around 500 feet below ground, they say, they did what they call pretty typical ways to kill the well from above, by pumping various fluids and brine and boron and other things from the top. What that did, didn't stop any leak, but it eroded away all the earth around the actual well, the pipe and the various components that go down in the ground, the man-made parts. It eroded all the earth from around that, so that I don't know how many feet of pipe is just sticking up unsupported by the earth. So they have it, you know, tied down with some cables to support it. And the concern is that because that thing is so unsupported, that the well head itself, which sits on top of all the pipe, could be compromised, break, whatever. And then you'd have a full-on blowout, you know, straight line from 8,500 feet downward, 2,500 PSI pressure, straight into Porter Ranch.
Well, I think it's worth reminding everybody that the pipes that you're talking about, this that go down to this massive storage of gas in an old depleted oil well, they're 61 years old.
Yeah, this particular one was built in 1954. It was built for one reason back then, to withdraw oil. It was a one-way trip for oil under whatever, you know, way different pressure situation than we have now. So the oil would come up, and that was how they were designed, whatever, 56 years ago. Now they have repurposed them to work under high pressure of injecting gas in and withdrawing gas out at much higher pressures than probably the oil ever existed. But it's still 1954 technology, and 1954 cement, which is only partially cemented. The cement casing doesn't even go the whole length. And the other piping is 1954, sitting exposed to open earth for, you know, close to 8,500 feet. And any seventh grader can tell you about rust.
Again, I'm speaking with Mac Pacuco, who is a music producer and engineer based in Porter Ranch, California. He co-founded Save Porter Ranch back in April, and now he is...
2014.
April 2014. That's over a year and a half, right? And now, of course, he's engaged in spreading awareness of the ongoing methane leak, urging lawmakers to act. And, of course, this leak began back in October. And every day it puts out, I've heard extraordinary statistics, something like the pollution, the equivalent to 7 million cars on the roads. So this is not just a huge injury to the people in Porter Ranch who have to evacuate their homes, and we're talking about, 12,000 people involved in that. This is also, I think, an insult and an assault and, in fact, a crime against the planet, because methane is such a virulent global warming gas, and people are more and more aware that of the climate change is happening because of global warming from CO2, and now this unabated, this methane's pouring out. So what's going on then with the Southern California Air Quality Management District? They postponed a meeting. My understanding is they're having a meeting on Wednesday at their headquarters, which are many miles, hours drive from where the local residents are. What are the authorities doing? How much are they stepping up to the plate here?
Well, on the AQMD hearing, they did have two hearings yesterday and the previous Saturday here in Porter Ranch, and there was so much public comment. People are allowed to publicly just speak for 2 minutes and give written testimony as well, but there was so much of that they were not able to complete everything they needed to complete. They're done with the testimony, so they decided, oh, we're going to go our way, an hour drive away from Porter Ranch and finish our deliberations. And so everyone's lives up here are pretty disheveled, so it's going to be difficult for the residents affected to actually be at the hearing. So Save Porter Ranch is working behind the scenes with Senator Pavley's office to get that brought back to Porter Ranch.
And what's happening with this idea of trying to cap the leakage, this volcano spewing forth methane since October? Is that a viable idea, that they can capture some of the gas? I've heard reports from engineers that there's a danger that the gas could be ignited.
Now, it's funny. They have, from the beginning, said so many times that there's such a huge risk of ignition because there's so much methane in the air that is their biggest concern, and workers cannot even have a watch or a cell phone anywhere near the thing. But then they decided, oh, we'll come up with this brilliant plan, and I don't know about the technology, but I do know about common sense. This plan to capture it at the leak, pipe it over some distance away, and they will build this furnace where they will then burn off the gas. Now, what's wrong with this picture? All they've been saying is the danger of ignition up there, and now they want to put a big furnace. Now, in Porter Ranch, the winds blow like crazy. It's a very windy part of L.A. So I don't know what distance they think is safe, because that methane is blowing many miles away right now. So they're going to put it, 100 feet, 500 feet, 1,000 feet? I don't know. One gust of wind could blow that main plume straight over this furnace. So our concern is, we know what we're dealing with right now. We're out of our homes for months, and that's one thing, and that's horrible. But one wrong move with this incineration process, and up here in a drought and a high fire risk area and a big furnace and a huge plume of methane, come on, what's wrong with this picture? You could lose the entire, Porter Ranch, Granada Hills, and the surrounding area could go up in flame if they mess it up.
So given the dangers involved in that scenario, the only other scenario is the one that's underway, where they're drilling all the way down to the well itself to try and plug it, which is similar to what happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And, of course, that takes, months? And it's a very tricky operation to begin with. So where does that stand?
Well, they have the relief well underway, and it's gone some good distance. Their anticipation of having that thing done, if it goes well, you know, sometime in March, give or take a few weeks, depending on whatever things, other things might happen. And they also have, in case their surefire relief well doesn't work, they have another relief well. And I don't think they've even started drilling yet. They're preparing the pad, but they haven't started drilling yet, as far as I know, from the last reports. And again, if this first one doesn't work and they have to do the second one, they haven't even started drilling it. So the relief well, yeah, when that thing, that's supposed to go all the way to the bottom, and they say, oh, that's pretty much for sure going to work. Of course, there's no guarantee, but that's the plan right now with the backup plan of the second well.
But that's a relief well is a tricky business, isn't it? You've got thousands of feet down, and you've got to actually intersect the existing pipe and then pump all this slurry in to plug the old pipe. They may not get lucky.
You know, it's funny. The target they're aiming for, 8,500 feet down, is about, you know, 3 inches wide, and then they have to pump all this stuff into that thing, and supposedly will work. But you know, it's pretty much the exact same thing as the Gulf Coast BP oil spill. So. And what if they miss the target? What if it doesn't work? I'm really concerned that, because everything they've tried from above ground has not worked. And the second relief well has not begun to be drilled. So, I don't know, it's pretty concerning.
Well, I'm surprised that when this thing began in October, they didn't figure out, well, you know, the best and most responsible thing to do, if possible, would be to capture that gas and put it in the system and use that gas first to deplete this well and shut off all other supplies. Wouldn't that have made more sense than allow this stuff to go up into the atmosphere and at any moment it could all explode?
Well, the thing about methane, the way I understand it, is there's a certain mixture of methane and oxygen that is combustible. Now, the way it's coming out of the ground now, there's definitely the mixture exists right at where it's coming out. That's why they're concerned about any kind of ignition source. But if they capture it in an enclosed space, with there's going to be some oxygen in this enclosed capture space already, so they're going to have a containment with a good mixture for ignition. So I think that's part of the reason they didn't do that. I mean, on one hand, it sounds like it makes sense, but
sure. Well,
I think they could have containment vessels around every well, kind of like a nuclear reactor does.
Right.
No one does that now.
Right.
But it would seem like that kind of scenario would work. But for whatever reason, all the powers that be say they're not going to do that.
Well, Matt Pakuka, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Pakuka, who's a music producer and engineer based in Porter Ranch, California. He co-founded Save Porter Ranch back in April of 2014. And since the October leakage of methane, he has been spreading awareness of the ongoing methane leak and urging lawmakers to act. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.